Welcome to the keynote stage. So my name is Mark Walsh. I'm the founder of this conference and part of the leadership team with Daniela and Manel. We have got quite a feast, quite a treat in store for you. The main stage doesn't have all the top names on. Some of them are spread out for various logistical reasons, but there are some awesome presenters on this stage. This stage is also sponsored by Alain Stefani. When we first had the idea of getting sponsors, I basically said, I won't take anyone as a sponsor unless I love what they do, because otherwise it doesn't have any integrity for me. I didn't know who Alain Stefani was, but I met her in Berlin. Someone said, oh, she's an intimacy teacher, she's an ex-sex worker, best-selling author in Germany. And I said, okay, well, I'll meet her. And I met her. And as soon as I met her, I felt at ease. I felt like, wow, this is a person who's playful, but also a deep listener. This is a woman who's a real leader. Since I've seen her work with people in very, you know, around trauma, around intimacy, around very difficult areas, men and women, I've come to regard her as a friend, actually. Like, I love her. So go to her website and check it out. It's Alain, I-L-A-N, Stefani, S-T-E-P-H-A-N for November, I. AlainStefani.com. There's an offer there called Love and Rage, which is as juicy as it sounds. You'll also find links in the descriptions for the videos below. Okay, welcome to the Embodiment Conference, everyone. People from around the world, at least 3,000 people gathered in. Of course, it's Dr. Gabor Maté here today. So he doesn't need much introduction, because I know most of you know Dr. Gabor Maté's work. He, of course, is famous for working with trauma. I guess for me, what Gabor's work brought into trauma was the social aspect, saying, you know, yes, it's the individual, but it's also the society. It could be to do with racism. It could be to do with intergenerational work. The bigger picture of trauma is what I've gotten from Gabor's work. Also, he's knowledgeable about a number of other topics, for example, ADHD, the author of several books, ex-clinician based in Canada. Gabor Maté, sir, welcome.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So maybe we'll start with a little bit about sort of your own story. Do you want to say a little bit about your own history and how you got interested in this, or launch into your favorite topic? Eva's fine with me.
You mean you wanted me to talk about myself?
A little bit of context for people.
My favorite topic. So my background is, I was born in Hungary, moved to Canada when I was 13 after the Hungarian Revolution in 56. I'm now 76 years old. I was a physician, a family practitioner I was in medical practice for 32 years, 20 of them in family practice. For 7 years, I was also a palliative care physician working with dying people. So really I was covering everything from birth to death. And then for 12 years, I worked in one of the world's most concentrated areas of drug use, which is Vancouver's downtown east side. So I got deeply into addiction work. And along the way, I've written 4 books and beginning with a book on ADHD, attention deficit disorder, with which I was diagnosed when I was in my 50s. And what I was always interested in, as you said, Mark, was the connection between the individual and the social. Because if you could look at something like ADHD, the diagnosis is burgeoning over the last few decades. Many more kids and adults are diagnosed with it. And in countries that never used to have it, now you're getting it diagnosed. So the usual medical mantra around mental illnesses and physical illnesses often is that it's either we don't know what causes it or that it's some kind of a genetic problem. But if you look at something like ADHD, just as a specific example, it can't be genetic because genes don't change in a population over 10, 20 or 30 or 40 or 100 years. So there's going to be something driving it that's beyond the individual, that's beyond the biology of the individual. And what I'm interested in always in my work is the relationship between the person and the environment. So I know you have another very well-known speaker in your conference, Dr. Dan Siegel. And Dan talks about, he's got this concept of interpersonal neurobiology, which is one way of looking at the brain and the mind as not just looking at it physiologically, but also looking at it anthropologically, psychologically, socially, politically, historically, psychiatrically, in every possible way. But what interpersonal neurobiology also means is that our brains are actually connected to one another. Our nervous systems are connected to one another. You and I, as we interact right now, are affecting each other's neurology and their neurobiology. Well, if I just take that as a physician, as a medical doctor, I take that one step further. And I say, if you and I are affecting each other's neurobiology, then we're also affecting each other's biology, because it's all one system. So our nervous system is connected to our hormones, our immune system, our psychological apparatus, our guts and our heart. It's all one system. So if people affect each other's nervous systems, which obviously they do, they also affect each other's biology. So let me give you a couple of examples of what I'm talking about. A study last year showed that women with post-traumatic stress disorder have doubled the risk of ovarian cancer. Now you think, well, what's the connection? Or let me give you another study. An American black woman, the more episodes of racism she experiences, the greater her risk for asthma. Which must mean, number one, that the emotions have an impact on the physiology. And we know they do. We know from laboratory experiments that laboratory mice, if you inject them with ovarian cancer cells, and then you stress them, and you compare them with mice who are injected with the same ovarian cancer cells, but they're not stressed, the stressed rats have a much higher chance of having that cancer spread and continue. Which means that emotional stress has a huge impact on people's physiology. Now, but emotional stress doesn't happen in a vacuum. Racism in the United States is not an individual problem. It's a social problem. So if a black woman experiences racism, and the more she experiences it, the greater her risk for asthma, does that make the asthma an individual physiological pulmonary disease? Or does her asthma reflect a social problem? Clearly both, and the two are in interaction. So what I'm interested in always is, what is the context in which what we call disease arises, whether it's physical illness, you know, like cancer or autoimmune disease or, you know, eczema or whatever it is. What is the context? Or whether we're talking about so-called mental illnesses like ADHD, depression, which is rising in the world exponentially, and so on. And so for me, it's always contextual. And there was an American physician in 1977 called Dr. George Engel, who talked about the narrowness of the medical perspective, which looks at things only biologically. And he said, really, we have to have a, what he called a biopsychosocial perspective, that the biology is inseparable from the psychology, and both are inseparable from the social context. So no matter what problem I'm looking at, whether it's, again, ADHD or depression or psychosis or addiction, which I worked with all those years, or autoimmune disease or cancer, inflammatory bowel disease, whatever it is, they're not just individual problems. They reflect relationships, and they reflect relationships in a particular culture. So that's what my focus has been. And this line of inquiry is not original with me, obviously. In Germany, there was a very famous doctor called Rudolf Virchow, a very famous physician. His work is still a guiding light. But he said way back in the 1860s that you can't separate politics from medicine, that actually medicine is a continuation of politics and vice versa. He said that in mid-19th century. So that's my perspective, and all my work flows from that point of view.
Thank you. So the importance of context, that the political, the social, the cultural can't be removed from biology. And would you say that that narrowness is a kind of cultural accident of history, or do you think there's something a bit more to it than that?
Would you repeat the question, Mark?
Yeah, the narrowness of focus on the sort of biological or the individual. Do you see that as simply a kind of cultural accident, or would you say, hey, that's a political setup in and of itself?
You know, it's an interesting question because let's face it, modern medicine has got tremendous achievements to its credit. I mean, it's unbelievable what they can do. Heart transplants, lung transplants, you know. But in part because of the success of the biological approach, we've forgotten the larger perspective. So medicine in general, doctors in general, used to have a broader perspective, somewhat. And this goes back to ancient times. But with the rise of modern industrialism and capitalism and the ideological separation of the mind from the body, let alone the spirit, we've become more and more biologically minded. And we've been able to achieve some great successes. So in a sense, we become the victim of our own success. Our very successes have narrowed our perspective to the point where the things that I've said about the unity of mind and body, you know, these aren't insights that I've had. I mean, yes, I used to notice it in my practice, but it's been documented. Volumes of texts have been published on it, tens of thousands of studies showing the mind-body unity, showing how from conception onwards, already in the womb, people are affected by the environment. Mothers, for example, who are stressed, are in pregnancy, their children's stressor apparatus is affected for a lifetime, which is a setup for illness. So I could go on and on and on, but what I'm saying is that there's literally tens of thousands of such studies, and these studies are not presented in the medical schools. So most physicians are trained absolutely ignorant of the mind-body unity, let alone of the biopsychosocial perspective. So if you look at something like addiction, which I've been very interested in one of my books, is an addiction. And I have to say, I hope not self-servingly, that the perspective that I'm transmitting is of a lot of interest to people. My books have been published in over 25 languages now. You know, but people really want to know this knowledge. And physicians, when they find out, they get excited about it. But they don't tend to find out in their education. So if you look at like addiction, which is believed to be this genetic disease, which it isn't. A, it's not a disease, and B, it's not genetic. It's rooted in trauma. When I was working in the downtown east side of Vancouver, over 12 years in that area, I didn't have a single female patient who had not been sexually abused as a child. And that abuse affects the body and the brain and the psyche and the spirit. And yet, and that's not only my impression, by the way, multiple studies have shown the relationship between addiction and trauma. The average medical student in the average medical school in the Western world does not receive a single lecture on trauma in 4 years of education.
Wow.
Except in terms of physical trauma, like bone fractures and so on. But emotional trauma, as it affects the brain, as it affects the whole physiology of the body, as it affects the immune system, as it affects the nervous system. Let me give you an example. Studies in Canada. Males who were sexually abused, their chance of heart attack doubles as adults, regardless of whether they smoke or drink or not. Or males sexually abused, another Canadian study, their chance of cancer is 50% greater, nearly 50% greater. Not because of their lifestyle, but because of what happened to them in childhood. Now, you would think that study alone would send every medical investigator and clinician chasing to find out the connection and how to deal with it. Because what I'm really saying is that illnesses, whether of the body and the mind, are for the most part themselves symptoms of a life. They're not isolated entities. Now, there are some illnesses that are genetic. There's one called muscular dystrophy that runs in my own family. My mother had it, my aunt had it. If you've got the gene, you'll have the disease. But those diseases are like one in 10,000. And most of the illnesses that we're plagued with in the modern world, diabetes, heart disease, depression, high blood pressure, and all their complications, these have to do with the environment and the interaction of mind and body. And yet the average physician, for no fault of their own, is not trained in that. They have no way of understanding it. So if there's about 5,000 people in this audience right now, as I can see, ask yourself this question. I won't be able to see the hands, but ask yourself this question. In the last year or so, or 2 years, have you ever been to any kind of a specialist, a pulmonologist, you know, a lung specialist, or a cardiologist, or a nephrologist for kidney disease, or a dermatologist for skin disease, or gastroenterologist for gut problems? And if you have, just silently raise your hand to yourself. And now ask yourself this question. When I saw this specialist, did they ask me about my childhood? Did they ask me about any childhood trauma? Did they ask me about stresses in my family of origin? Did they ask me about my stress on the job right now? Did they ask me about what stresses I'm experiencing in my life right now? Did they ask me how I feel about myself as a human being? Did they ask me about my sense of self-identity? And yet these questions, I can't prove them to you in this brief conversation, but I'm telling you, they're germane to your illness in almost every case. And for the new book that I'm writing, well, let me show you something. So this is a book I've been reading. It's called Cured. It's by Dr. Jeff Rediger, who's a psychiatrist at Harvard, and he's the head of a hospital there, the medical director of a hospital. And Cured is about what he calls spontaneous remissions. These are people whose diagnoses are terminal, either because medical treatment failed or because they choose not to have medical treatment, and they get better anyway. Miraculously, they get better. We call these spontaneous remissions. Okay, now he's not the only one that studies these things. There's also an American psychologist called Dr. Kelly Turner, wrote a book called Radical Remission, where she documents, again, multiple dozens of cases of people who are not supposed to get better, supposed to die, but they get better. I've talked to such cases. Now, I'm not advocating that people should refuse medical treatment, far from it. But what I'm saying is that sometimes, regardless of these dire prognoses that we give people, even from ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, this degenerative neurological disease that Stephen Hawking had, the physicist, that is supposed to kill you within 10 years. Stephen Hawking lived with it for over 50 years. And he was supposed to have been dead in 2 years. He outlived his prognosis by over 50 years. I know of people who've recovered from it. Well, Jeff Rediger, who wrote this book, Cured, he tells me that there's no such thing as a spontaneous remission. It's not spontaneous. Something happens. And what happens in every case, and this is my own personal experience as well, in my personal observation, is the people who do really, really well, they transform their identity. They transform their relations to themselves. They become more authentic. They connect with their true feelings, with their gut feelings. They follow their inner guide. Again, I'm not recommending anything to anybody. But what I'm saying is that if the transformation of identity can be so powerful in reversing so-called terminal diseases. That means that identity must have to do with who develops disease in the first place. And I have found that in every case of chronic illness, where it's not genetic, where it's not obviously a toxin or a radiation or a virus that's causing it, but that in every case of chronic illness, it's people's relationship to themselves that's the determinant factor. And that relationship to themselves has to do with how they grew up, in what kind of family origin, how they were treated, how they experienced themselves, and what kind of culture they grew up in. So this is why I'm saying that it's all biopsychosocial, and that when it comes to dealing with what we call mental illness, or and I say what we call because there's another way to look at it, or physical illness, you have to ask all the questions, not just the biological ones.
Thank you, Gabor. Well, let's have a look at some of the questions. Luke, can you scroll up to the top and we'll see which ones are sort of most popular, upvoted? We have this nice system here where you can look at other people's questions and see which ones are there. People still want to see the compassionate inquiry process. And I maybe ahead of them, people are also curious about PTSD or complex PTSD in COVID-19 times. Sort of what's your sense of where we're at now and how this might interact with stress and trauma?
Well, so here's what we know, that the incidence of overdoses has gone up here in Vancouver because of COVID, as a result of COVID, not just in Vancouver, but elsewhere as well. That incidence of domestic violence has gone up, which means what? Which means that when there's underlying traumas and stresses, and people lose the venues, the avenues through which they can relieve those stresses by going to work or going to a football game or going to a pub or whatever they do, then those stresses will explode. So that COVID has been a huge stress on everybody. I mean, for some people, a lot more than others. You know, I have not personally faced either financial or much personal inconvenience because of COVID, because I've been writing at home, sitting at home, writing a book. So even the usual travel and speaking that I do, I wasn't going to do anyway because I was going to be at home. Mind you, some trips have been canceled for this fall, but that's a good thing because I haven't finished my book yet. So I'm fortunate to have been forced to stay home. But what I'm saying is that even myself, in a quite a privileged position, I felt the heaviness of COVID. When I go swimming now, which I can do, fortunately, but the community center is deserted. Only a few people can go at it at a time. That feels weird. It's weird to see people in the street and have to walk around them. There's a kind of heaviness that affects everybody, and let alone the people who lose their jobs, who have to stay in housing that's already inadequate and now they're forced to stay in it most of the time. So of course people are stressed, and when people are stressed, that'll exacerbate the underlying trauma that they're already carrying.
I really felt it in London yesterday. I popped out to get some flowers for the team to say, hey, well done, celebration, we started, the conference is going great. And yes, just in the supermarket, you know, people had the masks, there was a tension and a fear. And I thought, you know, even if nothing bad had happened to me, and I'm very fortunate, I'm very privileged, there's still something different in my body that's making this, even this little trip to the supermarket, a little bit more difficult and unpleasant.
Well, talk about biopsychosocial, because there's your biology being, and you can feel it in your body, being affected by a different emotional, social environment, you know? And so, I think it's really important to keep that perspective in mind. And it also means, by the way, that, like, let's say, speaking of COVID, so your prime minister, Boris Johnson, who used to be somewhat overweight, lands in hospital with COVID. And he had a fairly you know, a serious case of it, needing to be in intensive care unit, I think. So he comes out and he becomes an advocate for weight loss, recognizing that extra weight is a risk for suppressing the immune system and therefore contracting COVID. But here's what Boris Johnson hasn't said, which is that the neoliberal policies which have cut down social supports and have led to social insecurity and have disrupted communities in Britain since the days of Margaret Thatcher have greatly contributed to the epidemic of obesity in England. So that obesity has gone way up in England in the last decades, not just because of people's individual bad habits, but these habits reflect coping mechanisms. People eat junk food because they're addictive. They soothe the brain. When do people need that? When they're stressed. Why are they stressed? When their communities are being destroyed, when their employment is being threatened, when inequality is rising. So if you look at something like obesity, there's no use pointing fingers at individual people. Why is it that it's always the most downtrodden, the most isolated, the people lowest on the social rung that tend to be more overweight because they're the most stressed? That's not an individual problem. That's a social problem. And so, yeah, it's good for Boris for instituting healthier eating campaigns in Britain. But let him look to the social structure and the social programs that have fueled that epidemic of obesity as well. And then, of course, they're not going to do that. Because to do that, they'd have to look at the very nature of the society which they govern.
Thank you, Gabor. The importance of context once again there. And I can see by far the most popular thing from people watching is the people are really curious about this compassionate inquiry process. Mm-hmm. I've heard good things. I'm prepared to step in myself. Well, there's another member of staff, if that would be more appropriate in the background, who can step in. Would you be willing to give that a go?
Absolutely. So allow me to say something about what compassionate inquiry is. So as a family physician, I began to see these links between people's stresses and people's illnesses. And I began to see the larger multi-generational picture. I thought, well, what am I going to do about this? So I realized that, for example, people with autoimmune disease, rheumatoid arthritis, they're very often were people that really suppressed their anger, very nice people, always trying to help everybody else, but they didn't look after themselves so much. And the flare-ups reflected that. So people with multiple sclerosis or arthritis, they tend to have flare-ups when they're stressed. That's not just my opinion. Literature shows that. Which means that dealing with stress, there might be a way of preventing a flare-up, which it actually is. Which means people can actually learn from their illnesses, which is amazing. We actually look at illness as a teacher. Not that I recommend that teacher to anybody, but once it's there, you might as well learn from it. But then as a physician, what would I do? Well, I need to send people for counseling. But in my area of Vancouver, people didn't have the money to afford private counseling. And the psychiatrists that were paid by the medical plan were not trained in counseling. Most psychiatrists are trained in handing out pills. They get very little training in normal human psychology, how to deal with trauma or stress and so on. So I started to counsel people myself. I have to say, initially, very haltingly, ineptly, but then I began to sort of get better at it. And then over the decades, I developed this method, which then people said, well, teach me your method. And I said, I don't have a method to teach because I didn't learn any method. I'm just doing it. Turns out there is something to teach, and we've called the method compassionate inquiry. And here's the essence of it. And this is a program I teach now online. People can either do it privately at a much lower cost, or they can sign up to be trainees in it if they're professionals. You can check it out, compassionate inquiry. But the essence of it is that everything has a reason. if you get upset, there's a reason for it. But the reason is usually not the reason you think it is. It's more rooted in past trauma. If you get ill, there's a reason for it. If you have certain emotions, if you behave in certain ways, there's always reasons for it. And if there's parts of you that you don't like, that you really criticize, there's even a reason for them existing. And so rather than condemn anybody else or yourself for any way of being, how about inquiring as to why a person behaves that way, why a person thinks that way, why a person feels that way? So that's the inquiry part. The compassionate part is that there's no judgment here. There's just curiosity. So that no part of me or you should be judged. Not even the parts that you think have done a lot of harm to you or other people. So before we do the compassionate inquiry process, let me just give you one quick example, okay? Take something like addiction. So I'll define, and everybody's listening, just ask yourself, just think along with me here. So I'll define addiction not as drug use. People think addiction, it's got to be drugs. No, it doesn't. I'll define addiction as any behavior that a person finds temporary pleasure or relief in and therefore craves, but suffers negative consequences in the long term, and they don't give it up despite the negative consequences. So I said any behavior. Drugs, yes. Nicotine, yes. Alcohol, yes. Sex, gambling, internet, sports, work, pornography, eating, shopping, self-harming, bulimia, any chronic behavior that you crave that gives you temporary relief for pleasure, negative consequences, and you don't, that's what an addiction is. Now, this can be, and absolutely, somebody says spiritual seeking. Yes, you can be addicted to spiritual seeking, which doesn't mean that spiritual seeking is bad. What I'm actually saying is it's your relationship to it that makes it addictive or not. So then the question then is, if you ask yourself this, and Mark, you ask yourself this question, according to my definition, have you ever had an addictive pattern in your life? And you don't have to tell me what it is. I'm just curious, yes or no. I'm not going to ask what it is.
Yes, I'm in long-term sobriety, actually.
Okay, great. So let me ask you this now. Not what was wrong with the addiction, whatever it was, but what was right about it? What did it do for you? What did you like about it in the short term? What did it give you?
When I was drinking alcohol, it definitely helped me feel safe and at ease and not agitated.
Okay, so it calmed you, it gave you safety, it gave you ease. Are those good things or bad things?
It was definitely a lifesaver.
Absolutely. In other words, you didn't have a disease. You had a problem that you weren't at ease in your own body, that you couldn't experience calm, that you didn't feel safe. And so rather than condemning the addiction, we actually see it as something, as an adaptive mechanism in your life that came along for some reason. And that's the inquiry. And that's what I mean by compassionate inquiry. Because shall we condemn the addict in you? Or shall we have compassion in the person in you that didn't feel safe, at ease and calm in their own body? And that's what I mean by compassionate inquiry. So having said that, if you want to be the subject here, I'm happy to have you do that. How we do this is you tell me any issue, incident, problem in your life that you'd like to look at. And by the way, I can't guarantee anything, you know, this is simply a process. I may help you, I may not help you. And the other thing is, any question, before we begin, there's two things you need to know. One is I interrupt okay, when I think it's necessary. Number one. Number two, any question you ask, it's absolutely important that you feel safe here. So that there's no obligation on you to answer any question I ask you. So if something doesn't feel right, if anything doesn't feel right, I hope you'll be able to tell me. Because it's not an inquisition, it's an inquiry.
Okay, Luke, can you turn the chat off? I really trust Gabor, but I'm also aware that all the comments coming up are kind of a bit much. So let's turn the comments box off for now.
Okay. So you tell me now what you'd like to look at in your life. Incident, relationship, problem, issue within yourself, whatever it happens to be.
I'll pick one I'm happy to share with 5,000 people. I've been eating a lot of sort of sugar and junk food lately. I think I've been quite stressed with the conference organizing, and I found myself kind of eating food I don't normally eat that isn't particularly healthy.
And what would you like to find out about that?
I guess it's just stress related, but it's also like, is there another way of, it doesn't feel like something I want to do for 2 weeks while leading an embodiment conference, you know?
How do you feel about doing that?
There's a little part of me is like a bit of guilt and shame. Like I noticed my kind of shirt looking a bit tired. I was feeling a bit of body shame, and I logically tell myself, hey, you know, you don't believe in that. I'm body positive, but there's still a little bit of that going on.
So would you like to look at the shame part of it?
Yeah, okay.
I think what would be helpful to you if by the end of this conversation, you could choose to eat as ridiculously as you want, or choose to eat in a more healthy fashion, but in either way, you didn't beat yourself about it. In other words, if there's some freedom in it for you. Okay, fair enough. So, maybe tell me the last time you ate in this addictive fashion.
I found myself having a very sweet drink, like a soda, before this call. I was kind of tired, and I was like a bit nervous about, you know, being on with Gabor Mate and a big audience. And I found myself sort of craving, like I needed something, you know? And then it was a sort of grasping and like a little bit of guilt, like, oh, I shouldn't be drinking this, and oh, maybe I should move it off camera in case anyone sees, you know, something like that.
Okay. So let me ask you this, first of all, if I told you that this morning, knowing that I'll be speaking at this big international conference, thousands of people, I was feeling a bit nervous, and I thought a bit of a soda, you know, sugar soda drink would calm me down. So I had that drink. Would you point to me and say, Gabor, you're being ridiculous, you're guilty, you should be ashamed of yourself?
No, I'd say that's very human.
Is that what you tell me?
Yeah, I'd say, hey, man, it's not a big deal. It's very human.
All right. And I assume you say that to anybody, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So let's notice, Mark, that. But that's not what you said to yourself, though, you notice.
Yeah, I was being a bit harsher on myself than I would to someone else.
You notice that? So there's a double standard. There's 7 billion people in this world. 999,999 they can have a sugar drink without being ashamed of themselves. That's one category of human being. There's another category of human being which has one person belonging to it, and those are the ones who should be ashamed of themselves, and that's you. You notice that?
Seems a bit ridiculous when you put it like that, yeah.
No, let's not call it ridiculous. That's already a judgment, not very compassionate.
Okay.
Let's be curious about it. Now, why do you suppose you'd have that double standard? Any idea?
I don't know.
All right. Let's just quickly look into this. When you experience the shame and the guilt, can you check in with your body, like right now? It's not just a thought in your head. It's a physical state, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's in your body when you experience those, that state of shame and guilt?
It's kind of like a slight turning away and the tension.
So there's a tension there. Okay. My question is, how familiar is that to you? Is this something new, or is this something that you've experienced for a long time?
It feels old.
How old is, how, probably it feels very young, doesn't it?
The number that comes to mind is 4, just intuitively. I don't know why.
4 years of age. Okay. All right. So can you conceive then the possibility that this shame that you feel, this guilt that you feel, has nothing to do with the present moment? Because in the present moment, as an adult, you would not judge or shame anybody else for doing what you do.
No.
Therefore, it's a very old dynamic. You get that?
Mm-hmm.
So let's not call it ridiculous, because it isn't. When you actually think about it, is it ridiculous or is it sad that so many people judge themselves so harshly when they wouldn't judge others the same way? Is it ridiculous or is it more like something we could have compassion for?
Yeah. Yeah. I can feel that opening up. And when I say ridiculous, it's a smile and a laugh, and it's not a cruel judgment. Okay, right. It's like a letting go humor.
Okay. Very good. All right. Okay. I get that. But still, you can see that a bit of compassion would be helpful here. If we were compassionately a bit curious about how this came along. Okay, now, what did you have? Do you have children, Mark?
I don't have a children. I have a niece I adore.
Okay, great. Would you ever want her to feel guilty or ashamed of herself?
No, I'd want her to be happy.
And accepting herself, right?
For sure.
I mean, you want her to know the difference between right or wrong.
You want her to treat other people well and to treat herself well, yeah.
Yeah, but you don't want her to feel shame about herself.
No, I've seen that with her, and I feel real sad when I see if she does, you know, she does that. Yeah.
All right. So here's where the question comes in, and maybe you've already thought about this. But what shamed you as a child? How did you develop the sense of shame at age 4 that you never want your niece to experience?
And my dad was a drinker, and I grew up in quite a small village. And I guess probably about that age, I became aware that my dad did something that wasn't looked upon well in that village.
So you think that your shame came from your dad's behavior that evoked the judgment and condemnation of other people? Is that what you think?
Yeah, it comes to mind. I don't want to say anything bad about my dad, certainly not in front of so many people, but it comes to mind.
Fair enough. Well, we're not talking anything bad about your dad, because you remember what you said about your own addictive behavior? Why do you suppose your dad was drinking?
He was coping with his stuff too.
He was dealing with his own discomfort, his own lack of calm, his own trauma, right? So there's nobody being judged here. Not your dad, not anybody. But let's take it a bit deeper. Let's say you never went outside your house. So you never heard how the villagers felt about your dad. What was it like for you in that house?
I'm not clear here.
Well, how did your dad behave when he drank?
Not great.
Well, that's how he didn't behave. How did he behave?
Well, that feels too much to share so publicly. I can feel into it and I'm prepared to, but.
Okay, well, you certainly don't have to share anything, and thank you for setting that boundary. But let me ask you this question. Take your 4-year-old niece that you adore. She's 4, is she?
She's not now. She's a bit older now.
Oh, well, take her at age 4, okay? Plug her into your childhood home. How does she feel?
Yeah, I'd rather not, actually. I'd rather not put her there. But,
well, this is a mind experiment.
Yeah, she'd be scared. She'd be confused.
Would she feel uncomfortable in her skin?
Yeah.
That's how you felt? Okay. When you felt that way, who did you speak to about it?
Not my parents. Maybe my sister. She's in my mind today. Yeah. Sent me a letter my niece wrote to her teacher this morning. It was kind of cute.
But no nurturing adult, right?
No, it wasn't comfortable. No.
If your niece felt the way we imagine she might feel in that situation, and she had nobody to share it with, no nurturing adult to share it with, how do you think that would make her feel about her feelings? Why does
think she have, she'd struggle? Yeah,
she'd have a lot of shame, because shame is all about being alone and cut off from contact. Okay. So this is a very concentrated and a bit artificial demonstration, but all I've been trying to say, come to here, is that the shame that you experience, Mark, when you have that drink has nothing to do with having a sugar drink.
Yeah, bigger connection, bigger history.
It has to do with a dynamic that's inside you, have been inside you for at least the age of 4, probably before. So here's my suggestion to you. Have that drink or don't have that drink. But if the shame arises, just say hello to it. Don't believe it for a second. That shame is a 4-year-old little kid or younger. Now, if we had the time, which we don't, I think we should end this. Not the session, but the inquiry part of it. I would also ask you, why are you driving yourself hard? Why did you take on so much?
Why did you do a conference for 500,000 people?
Why did you do a conference? I can understand. I mean, it's a great thing that you've accomplished doing this conference, but how did you set it up? That it's all on you, and there's so much on you that you feel stressed, that there's no space inside it for yourself to take care of yourself. All those questions will be very relevant to how you live your life in general, I'm sure. And so I would go into those questions as well, but I won't. Are we complete? Are we okay for now? How are you feeling?
It was intense, but yeah. I felt kind of kindness and trust. At a certain point, I sort of forgot there was a monitor that said 6,000 below. I'm now kind of going more back into professional mode, as it were. But it was beautiful. Gabor, thank you. Really, kissing them. It was a beautiful experience.
Sivashan, which means you're welcome in Hungarian. I'm impressed that you could say so in Hungarian. And again, not, you know, for those of you that are therapists or professionals, you could check out this course, Compassion Inquiry, the training. It's very intense. Or for those of you that are interested in it personally, there's a short version available. I'm not trying to sell you anything, but I'm just informing you that you can check it out.
Okay, we need to wrap up relatively soon. Daniela, just to kind of give me a minute, what is a top question in the chat there that you can ask Gabor before we wrap this up?
Good to have friends. So there are a couple of questions being lighted up. Let me see. So So one question is coming up and got a few likes is there a way for you to talk more about what disconnection from the self means for you?
Okay. Well, there's degrees of it, but let me ask you this question, which everybody can relate to. Have you had the experience of facing a situation and having a gut a relationship, a situation, whatever it is, where something in you is saying, no, this is not right? There's a gut feeling that says, nah, but you went ahead and did it anyway. And you felt sorry afterwards. So Daniela, since you're on the line, can I ask you, have you had that situation? But there's a kind of a gut feeling that says, nah, I shouldn't go there. I shouldn't be with this person. No, but you didn't listen to yourself. Has that happened to you?
Actually, yes. And I completely suppressed it. And a friend came back to me 10 years later when I made the decision to leave that. You knew this in the first year you started that. You told me.
Okay. Well, that's an example of disconnect from the self. Mm. Because your gut feelings were right there. Now, here's the problem. It wasn't a mistake on your part. It was a dynamic that was instilled in you. You just told me about your childhood, whether you realize it or not. Maybe this is more personal than you want to get, but I'm not going to ask you any questions. I'm just going to say that infants are born totally connected to their gut feelings. At some point in your childhood, you learned that if I follow my gut feelings, I might get into trouble. Therefore, I need to suppress them. And that's what showed up in that relationship all those years later. So that's an example of the disconnect that almost everybody in this society experiences. And then we get into so much trouble because we get into all the stress and self-recrimination and all this stuff, you know? So that's the clearest example. But the reason we disconnect from our gut feelings is because our environment couldn't support our gut feelings. In fact, forced us to suppress them. So that's an example of disconnect from the self. Okay?
Yeah, it's powerful. Thank you.
Okay, we need to start to move towards wrap up. Gabo, we'll bring you in one more time at the end for a kind of top tip. We're making a book out of all our top tips. Website of Gabor's to share there, please, Daniela, for people who wanna find out more. I read his book on ADHD, both for me and my niece, and the Hungry Ghosts one is very good too. Of course, if you're watching this, you're part of the conference. There's lots of other good stuff coming up. Richard Strezzi Heckler tomorrow, for example, Laurie Saltzman, Charles Eisenstein tomorrow, who's really, really very good on our disconnect from the planet. I recommend Charles extremely, extremely. Sebastian Foucan, one of the founders of Parkour. If you haven't discovered the portal yet, have a look and see what's there. You can find things that maybe fit your needs, fit if you want to do something athletic or more intellectual. It makes it easy to find what you love. And of course, this is free for 48 hours if you want to watch it again. This library of recordings is, of course, available if you want to treat yourself to that. It's half price throughout the actual conference. For me, it's about digestion. You know, I'm going to have to watch this one again to digest it. And I'm sure for many of you to watch it in your own time, to find the things that you really love. You know, you don't miss anything that way. You know, it's pretty reasonably priced, particularly in installments. It also helps us out. It's a big thank you to us if you can afford it. And it makes the whole event free live to everybody else. So, you know, you are making this stuff accessible to everyone else. So, really appreciated, you know, with the show notes and all the other features in there. So that's in the upgrade. If you want that, if you don't, I'm not going to hard sell you. It's there if you want it. The whole thing's free for 48 hours. If you want to do us a favor and you can't afford that, please tell your friends. Tell people this is going on. Spread the word. So many more great speakers. If you're interested in trauma, you might like Stephen Porges, who I adore, Peter Levine. Who else we got? Oh, Alanis Morissette is doing a panel with several well-known trauma teachers. So do put those in your diary. If you want to chat about this session, we have the breakout rooms afterwards. So we can't do that here, because this is a keynote, but we have a feature we call coffee breaks, if you look for that on the system. And I find rather than just sort of being talked at by the experts, actually being able to discuss things with your friends is very nice. And of course, the Facebook group is there too. If you, again, you want to discuss things, share things, you know, much more conversational, then do join the Facebook group. Maybe Daniela can share the links. But as I said, if you want to help us out, if you want to digest in your own time, please do get the library of recordings. It's a bit of a treat. The British part of me always feels a bit awkward selling something, but in this case, it's pretty bloody awesome. So do enjoy that. Okay, Daniela, have I forgotten anything in my slightly emotional state that you need to remind me of?
No, maybe just mentioning that we see Dr. Marty again with the panel with Alanis Morissette, Dan Siegel, who else was on the panel? All the famous people.
It would be Dan Siegel, Dick Schwartz,
Richard Peter, Schwartz, yeah.
Peter Levine.
Peter Levine, yeah. That's going to be a treat. So if you want to...
And these people are people that I've learned from, so I look forward to being on the panel with them as well.
Unbelievable. Really looking
forward. Daniela, thank you for hosting. Gabor, that was intense and beautiful and wonderful for me personally, and I hope also a gift for everyone else watching. So I really hope this session was a gift to people. I think your work's so important that, you know, the word context doesn't sum up how important it is to realize that people's addictions and trauma happen in the context of inequality and other things like that that are vital to understand. So thank you for your work, sir. Do you have a final top tip or a final message to finish?
Well, just this, that we talk about trauma and we often think about trauma as something bad that happened a long time ago, which is not a helpful way to look at it, because if it happened a long time ago, what can you do about it? It already happened. But if we understand that trauma, as Peter Levine says, is actually the disconnect from ourselves, from other people, and from the world, then guess what? That disconnection can be repaired anytime, in this very moment. And so that disconnect, that reconnection is available to us. So it doesn't matter what happened, not that it doesn't matter what happened in the past, but no matter what happened in the past, and no matter how painful it was and how it's affected our lives, the reconnection is a possibility that lives with us as long as we live.
Dr. Gabor Maté, thank you very much for joining us at the Embodiment Conference.
My pleasure. Thank you.